Well, we thought perhaps it would be wise to say something about getting started in a marriage relationship. Obviously, we've had a series on marriage, but we want to get that started too. Choosing a husband or a wife with biblical values and a life of service to Christ in mind. Obviously, many Christians never receive direct training or teaching on choosing a mate. Not all parents provide that kind of guidance or those kinds of expectations. I have said before, no parent wants to see their child divorced, but if you don't prepare them for marriage, including what kind of person to marry, then you're not helping to prevent that divorce either. So it's really not about just avoiding divorce, but really just putting someone on a path that leads in the right direction. And then we go to the other side of the problem. When we talk about problems, it's not just the parents. Sometimes young people just don't want to listen. They don't want to listen to their parents. They don't want to listen to the church. They don't want to listen to people who've been there and done that, whether it be good or bad. They don't want to listen to good advice. And simply, they don't want to listen to the Bible. And they might put more stock in their friends and in their immediate gratification than in their long-term investments. And then later, they sorely regret this, of course. But up front, they're just thinking that they're too smart for everyone. I know what that's like. I've been there where I thought I was smarter than all the other adults on the planet. It's just part of growing up. But I also was at least smart enough to realize that as I got older and started to watch people and their lives and the direction they took, that there's a right way in which to walk, and there's also a lot of wrong ways. And God is in charge of the right way, and people often choose the wrong way. For the sake of this lesson, though, let's just assume that we have the parents' full and active support, and we have young people's full and interested attention. And what would be the best advice, given those circumstances, that we as parents could give our children with regard to choosing a mate for life? The first thing I would recommend that you understand is that no list is perfect, since God didn't write a specific list. You're not going to be able to go into your Bible and find a list of, choosing a mate qualifications or any such thing like that. And so there's none of that, but nonetheless, there are enough principles and implications and lessons learned in Scripture to provide a fairly good and accurate assessment of what to do or what not to do. I think the second thing here we should consider is that there's no such thing as a perfect spouse. And no young people here will find a perfect spouse or be one themselves. I think that's just realistic. And we need to come to terms with that. And by the way, there's this idea floating around in society right now that your soulmate is out there waiting for you to find them. I don't believe in soulmates. The Bible doesn't teach anything about soulmates per se. A lot of people could be a perfectly adequate husband or wife for you. You just need to find the right kind of person, not necessarily the one person on the planet that would be, yours for all eternity, or however you want to look at that, okay? It sounds good in movies and songs. It just doesn't work in practical, real life. I'm not suggesting that you look for perfection in this lesson, but I am strongly urging that you don't settle for the first candidate that shows interest in you, or someone that will merely be adequate in any sense, or anyone who raises red flags. And I'm going to bring up a bunch of red flags in this lesson here that you should think about. Secondly, take your time. Don't rush into something you didn't really put a whole lot of thought into, but is going to impact the rest of your life. This is a profound decision, who you marry, that is. And I strongly suggest that you take your time in making that decision. I also strongly suggest that you do not get married, this is Chad's opinion, before the age of 20. The reason for that, and this is why I suggest it, is because most boys are not mature enough in this day and age to be married before that age. And most young people, generally speaking, don't really know what they want until at least somewhere around that age. Or at least they're starting to realize what they want after that age. So that's Chad's advice for what it's worth, you do with that what you will. But I will say, keep your standards high, but not unrealistic. If no one, including yourself, can live up to your standard, then you're never going to find anyone. But at the same time, it's better not to marry at all than to marry someone who you never should have married in the first place. Because your standards were too low, or because you didn't bother to have any. Because that's just going to bring you a life of grief and heartache. And that's a lot of what this lesson is about, is trying to prevent you from entering into a life of grief and heartache. Beside the moral factor or the biblical or spiritual factors there of, you know, what you should be pursuing instead. So let's look at some criteria here. I'm going to call some of these serious red flag issues here. And if your marriage candidate, whoever you would consider for marriage, doesn't match these, then you, not me, but you ought to seriously question whether or not you ought to continue in a forward direction with that person at all. And the first one is going to be the most obvious, and that is to marry a Christian. And by Christian, I do not mean someone who is merely a churchgoer or who feels spiritual or seems religious or picks up his Bible or her Bible a couple times a year and flips through that, but one who is genuinely Christian. They demonstrate that in their life. They demonstrate that according to the biblical requirements. In other words, they don't feel like a Christian. They really are a Christian by definition. They walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. They walk in a manner worthy of His gospel. This is so, so important. It is critical to your marital success as a Christian. If you want a Christian home, like we just sang, then marry a Christian. Christians and non-Christians do not share the same beliefs. They do not share the same values. They do not share the same spiritual goals. This will lead to inevitable trouble for you, especially, and this is highly magnified when the children come along, because now you're going in this direction and your husband or wife is going in this direction spiritually, and the children are in the middle, and someone has to decide which direction are they going to go into. Which kind of teaching are we going to teach our children? Are we going to teach them your religion or my religion, if you will? And that really ends up dividing the family right there. And so many families have thought that, oh, it won't happen to me and so on, and it does, and then they realize it after the fact, and there's nothing that they can do about that then. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 and 15, I'll talk more about that in tonight's lesson. We're going to actually focus on this passage, but it simply says, do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial or Satan? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? And of course, the rhetorical questions lead to only one answer. There is nothing in common here. The context here is not literally marriage. I understand that. But it's also not separate from marriage either, because the principles most certainly apply. What has a believer in common with an unbeliever in the most important realm of all? That's something that you should consider if you're considering marrying anyone. Some, of course, will justify that love, true love, I was going to do the other Princess Bride version, is going to, you know, go over and gloss over and fix everything. And so they'll say things like, but I love him, or I love her, and that's supposed to end all discussion and take away all contradictions and everything else, as if love by itself makes all problems, warnings, red flags, etc., go away. Well, the thing is that God loves all people too, but most people do not love him in return and cause him all kinds of grief because of that. Love by itself is not enough to build a relationship on. In fact, if you think about it, real love, godly love, is not built on love alone. It's built on all the virtuous, noble factors that make love what it is, that make love love. We've talked a lot about this recently. Hopefully we still have that on our minds. Other people will say, and I've heard this so many times, well, I know that he or she's not a Christian, but I'm going to have a positive influence on him or her. Usually it's the woman saying this about her unbelieving boyfriend. And then they cite 1 Peter 3, verse 1 and 2, where it says, you know, that you're going to have a good effect on your unbelieving husband and win him over and so on. Peter is not talking about choosing to enter into a relationship with someone who is not a Christian. He's rather referring to finding yourself in that relationship when you become a Christian after you've been married and now your husband or wife is not a Christian yet. That's the context in which Peter's talking about. He never gives sanction to going into a relationship with that in mind, that, oh, I'll convert him. In my 30 plus years experience as a Christian, I have seen very few turnarounds where a girl is going to marry a boy and become his wife, and she's the Christian and he's not, and she goes into it with the attitude that I'm going to turn him around over time. He'll see the truth and he'll become a Christian and then we'll be together as Christians. It most often happens exactly the other way around, where the influence of that ungodly person, that unconverted person, has a negative influence or pull or dominating effect on the one who is a Christian, to the effect where that person ends up compromising their faith or just abandoning it altogether. I have seen this so many times. I have seen success stories. In fact, my friend Tom Betty in Alaska is one of those. He was not a Christian when his wife married him, and yet, you know, that did turn around. There is hope. But you're going against a lot of odds there. And statistically speaking, it usually does not work out that way. And that's not a very wise decision to go into a marriage with that perspective. Marry one who loves the Lord more than they love you. That's the simplest way that I can put this. Marry somebody who loves God even more than they profess to love you, or more than they do love you. This is an excellent criterion, because anyone who loves the Lord with that kind of zeal and that kind of devotion and dedication will always act in your best interest and become an excellent spouse for you. And that's really what Paul is talking about in Philippians chapter 2. I realize he's not talking anything about marriage per se, but he's talking about the kind of person that you would marry if you married someone who loves the Lord more than they love you. And here's a person who's going to do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, he's going to regard your interests as more important than his own. Why? Because he loves the Lord more than he loves you. And he's not only going to look out for his own personal interests, but he's going to look out for yours first. See, it all works in your favor if you marry that kind of person. Isn't that what you want? Don't say something like, I want someone who loves me more than anything. Actually, no, you don't. That's great for movies. It's great for love songs. It's great for fiction. But in real life, what you really want, ideally, is someone that loves God more than they love you. Marry someone who demonstrates faithfulness or fidelity to the relationship. Marriage is a covenant relationship. It must be honored and respected. Not only honoring the spouse, but also honoring that pact or that covenant, that binding agreement that holds you together. Throughout the New Testament, we see this phrase, God is faithful. And the reason he's faithful is because he is noble and virtuous and just. But what he's faithful to is not just the person himself, but to the relationship into which that person and God have entered into. The us, if you will. He's faithful to uphold that covenant agreement. And so your spouse or spouse-to-be must be a faithful kind of person. And here's the thing. If he or she is showing signs of unfaithfulness, moral irresponsibility, and flippant regard for your relationship now, you can just imagine that that is not going to improve once you say, I do. It's just going to get worse. If they're going to be bold and audacious enough to do that now, in other words, then they're going to be very comfortable doing that after they know they have you. One who has little respect for God likely will have little respect for the marriage covenant. So my advice strongly is keep your eyes open and observe what is happening in your relationship. And do not allow your emotions to cloud your judgment. Can't say that strongly enough. Do not allow your emotions to cloud your judgment. You may pay for that decision for the rest of your life. Marry someone who is honest. If a person will not be honest with you while you're dating them, when they ought to be putting on their best behavior, then you can be sure that they're not going to be very honest with you once you are married. It doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to recognize what heartache you're going to be entering into in the years to come. Honesty is not limited to just telling the truth when asked. It also refers to being truthful at all times, in all circumstances, whether or not a person is asked a direct question. Because an honest person is not afraid to be accountable. An honest person is not afraid when people ask questions. An honest person doesn't have anything to hide, especially nothing to hide behind clever wording or clever shades of meaning, you know, little nuances of language that we tend to hide behind, things that don't come right out and say what needs to be said, but kind of dances around. You probably know what I'm talking about, okay? So an honest person has nothing to hide. He will not only tell you what you want to hear, he'll just tell you the truth. And that's the kind of person you want to marry. Marry one who is forbearing and forgiving. These are not the same words. They don't mean the same things. Forbearance refers to someone who is willing to put up with you as an imperfect person. I don't mean morally imperfect. I mean that you don't always do things the way they are going to want you to do them. So what we're talking about then with forbearance is people that kind of irritate you sometimes, people that might upset you sometimes, people that don't always do things the way you want them done, but nonetheless, you put up with that because you're a forbearing person. Forgiveness has to do with sin. Now that that person has sinned against you, you need to forgive them. We never forbear sin, and we never forgive mere human idiosyncrasies. So let's not get these words mixed up. Let's understand what they mean, and then understand that you need a person who is forbearing and forgiving. You are not a perfect person, and if you marry someone who is legalistic and judgmental and unreasonably critical, you will not stand a chance of faring well and finding favor in their eyes in the years to come. They will always critique you. You will always be at fault. You will never be happy with that person in that scenario because they won't be happy with you. So what is in your best interest instead is to marry someone who can deal with your faults in a Christ-like manner. And that's exactly what Paul is talking about over here in Colossians chapter 3, which is one of my favorite passages to turn to with regard to any kind of marriage advice. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12 says, "So then, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another," there's that forbearance we talked about, "and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone. Just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity." This is the kind of person that you want to find, or as close to that as possible, okay? Again, realizing not everyone is flawless and perfect, neither are you, but this is the kind of person, the character of a person that you want to find. There are some other qualities or characteristics to avoid. First of all, do not, I can't emphasize this enough, do not marry anyone who is physically or mentally abusive. There are many wives, especially, who have married abusive husbands, abusive men. They become codependent upon them and they live the rest of their lives with that person in fear and misery and sometimes are actually killed by those people. If your friend is a controlling or physically domineering person or uses violence in any way as a means of getting his way or solving problems, my advice to you strongly, while you can, is run away. And do not let your emotions cloud your judgment and say, but I love him, okay? Because when he's pounding on you in some dark room there in the years to come, and you've got nowhere to go because he's threatened if you tell anyone he's going to kill you, then you're going to realize that that love you had for him might have been real, but wasn't enough to save you from what you entered into. Just because you love someone doesn't mean you need to spend the rest of your life with them. And just because you love somebody doesn't mean that they're going to change. And just because you love somebody doesn't mean that they're going to do what's right. You just need to understand the difference between I love you and are you the best fit for me? Do not marry someone with a bad temper, who is hostile, who is bitter, who has so-called anger issues, and then explodes in anger when he is frustrated or when things do not go his way. I'm using the male pronoun here because it's typically, but not always, men that have these kinds of problems. If he does this now, it will only be worse later when you are married, and you, wife, will be the object of his anger and his frustration. Do not marry someone with an addiction to anything, in essence, tobacco, alcohol, drugs, pornography, you name it, because they cannot give themselves to you as a lifelong companion if they've already given themselves over to some addictive compulsion. Basically, what they're saying is this thing that I'm married to already, this addiction, is more important to me than you are. Because if they're not willing to give that up first and have enough time to demonstrate that they have given that up, then you are not wise to marry that person. Please, please do not go into that emotional, love-struck idea that, well, but I can change him. Chances are you won't. In fact, chances are you'll be the one being changed. That's a short list of the critical issues. If your spouse-to-be doesn't make that list, then you ought to run away as fast as you can and find someone else. There are 7 billion people on this planet. The person that you are currently dating or seeing or thinking that you want to marry or they're thinking as a candidate, that choice there can be moved to a different person if necessary. They are not necessarily your soulmates. Your soul is far too important to be compromised by someone else's self-serving behavior or by their refusal to be morally responsible and accountable to God. You can ignore all what I'm saying if you want to, and some of you might. But it will be to your detriment. And I'm not saying also, let's be clear, that if your boyfriend or girlfriend doesn't have one of these problems that I have up on the screen here, then everything's going to be okay. I'm not saying that either. I'm just saying that these are the serious things. These are really serious. Here's some other qualities or characteristics that are worth looking for. If you are able, then marry a virgin, one who has not already given himself or herself to someone else in the most intimate manner. I know this is hard to do anymore because so many people aren't virgins by the time they even reach marrying age, and that includes Christians, by the way, sadly. But in Leviticus 21, verse 7 through 15, I realize it's Old Testament, but the principle is there. Old Testament priests were told to only marry virgins because it was a purity issue. In other words, they have not already corrupted themselves physically, sexually, with someone else. And God needs people to be pure in order to serve him. I realize that this factor, this condition may not be possible. And it may be you that is the problem because you are not a virgin. I realize that may be the case. All I'm saying is when possible, and hold to your standard here, when possible, I would strongly, strongly advise this. Secondly, marry someone who is not lazy. Whether it's a man or a woman, it doesn't matter. It's not one gender or the other that is prone to laziness. I see it pretty consistently on both sides. Laziness is a moral weakness, and laziness often leads to other problems such as dishonesty, freeloading or mooching off people, poverty, petty crimes, and other irresponsible actions that not only destroy the relationship, but drag you down with that destruction. Marry someone who wants children and who wants to raise those children and discipline those children like you do, more realistically, like should be done. Do not just assume that this is going to take care of itself later on. This is important information that needs to be discussed and known up front. I strongly advise that you are, if you're considering marrying someone, that you talk about this. Don't just think, oh, but we're in love, and because we're in love, we'll take care of that later, or it will take care of itself. No, it won't. And do not think, if you're having marital troubles later on, when you get into marital troubles, okay, that having children is going to fix those troubles, because all it does is complicate them. Anyone who's tried to solve their problems by having children finds out later on, usually very quickly, that it didn't solve anything, it just made them even worse. Because now, not only can we not get along, but now we got this kid that we don't know what to do with. And it just creates all kinds of friction and problems there. Marry someone who is loving and considerate, not just with you, but with all people. Someone has wisely said that you can tell what kind of person an individual is by watching how they treat the flight attendants, the table waitresses, the people that wait on them, and so on. However they treat them has a pretty good indicator of what kind of person they really are. Because they can be all flowery and talking nice to you, and then snap and be rude and so on to someone who is your server. And you should be perceptive to that and go, I think maybe I'm getting a false reading here, okay? Because this person's putting on a good show for me, but their true nature is coming out against that person. It won't take long before you're that person. And they start snapping and getting rude with you, because now that they've got you, once you're married, then they don't have to put on that nice face anymore. Marry someone who is loving and considerate. Love is a godly virtue, and the one who loves like God loves, will likely have a number of other virtues. Seek after someone who is honestly, genuinely striving to manifest that fruit of the Spirit that Paul talks about in Galatians chapter 5, verse 22 and 23. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, self-control, those are the kind of things that you want to look for in a person. Marry someone with common interests and common backgrounds. It doesn't mean everything has to be in common, but there has to be enough overlay, if you will, overlapping things there that you can enjoy things together and grow together, as opposed to spending a lot of time apart and then growing apart. I have said before, in fact, recently in our class, you know, Honey and I, we have a lot in common. We do a lot of things together, but we don't do everything together. Okay? She goes to Joanne Fabrics, I sit in the car. That's just the way it is. Right? We have an understanding, and I'm okay with that, and she's okay with that. But we do a lot of things together. What I'm getting at there is that we don't have to be together every moment of the day. We don't have to like everything that we do together. I play racquetball, she goes running. I can't stand to run, and I don't know if she knows how to play racquetball. And that's just the way it is, and we're okay with that. So find someone that you have a good measure of overlapping interests, someone that you can spend time with so that you don't have two separate lives and you just happen to live together in the same house. I have seen relationships like that. They are not happy ones. Marry someone that can accept constructive criticism and correction. Because a person who is hypersensitive, emotionally defensive, even hostile toward any kind of constructive criticism or any kind of correction is just simply broadcasting and proclaiming his insecurity and spiritual immaturity. In other words, if you can't just even offer some advice to someone without them getting all hostile and angry and you know, what do you know, and all that kind of stuff, then you need to walk away from that person. And you can even say, hey, I love you, but you're kind of an idiot when it comes to this. Oh, don't use that word. You could just simply say, you are not mature enough for me to enter into a relationship with you. Take that however you want to, but you need to be able to accept some criticism because you're not a perfect person just like I'm not. And so we need to be tolerant then of that constructive criticism and even, yes, that correction. And again, if your boyfriend or girlfriend or candidate there is not that person, then walk away. Find someone else. Again, there's 7 billion people on the planet. You could find someone else. Marry someone who is financially responsible, who knows the meaning of hard-earned money, who exhibits good management, good stewardship, and restraint towards spending. Here's the scenario. If your boyfriend, for example, is irresponsible with his own money, then you can guarantee that when he has your money as well, or your together money, he will be irresponsible with that as well. Doesn't that make sense? So find someone that is responsible for themselves, fiscally responsible is the right word to use here, financially responsible, so that you won't get dragged down into that swamp. And keep in mind that money issues is one of the leading factors of divorces. Marry someone who is optimistic, someone who is joyful, someone who has good self-esteem, someone who strives to do what is right, someone who lives by rejoice in the Lord always. Philippians 4, verse 4. Because you don't want to spend the rest of your life jacking up that person who's always down and depressed and needs you to, you know, make them feel better, and you're going to spend the rest of your life dealing with that because they can't do it on their own or really choose not to do it on their own. In summary, young women ought to be searching for a young man who will lead her and her family in the Lord, not someone that she has to drag to church or convince that, yeah, this Sunday we need to go again or into a Bible study, or who easily is willing to consider church and his church family and his church obligations as expendable. Because I see this so often today. There is an attitude in our society that says that spiritual things are really, really important unless, of course, something else comes up. And then they're expendable. And that has spilled over into the church, and we see it often even in our younger families. I'm not picking on this congregation. I'm talking about brotherhood-wide in our younger families, where church is something that we do if it doesn't conflict with whatever other schedule we have. And that's just very sad to see that. That's a serious character flaw with many young men, especially today. Do not let it be a point of compromise for you. 1 Timothy 3, verse 4 and 5, this is talking about candidates for elders, but it says that he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? You should be looking at a passage like that and saying, okay, I realize that my boyfriend is not an elder, may not be qualified to be an elder for another 30 years, but nonetheless, this is what I want. And if he doesn't exhibit signs of or a desire toward that very description there, then you should be looking for someone else. Or at least wait until he grows up. You might wait a while, I don't know. But nonetheless, I'm saying, don't just marry him anyway and hoping that, well, he'll change. Or I love him so much. I know I can change him. Chances are you won't. Christian leadership does not begin in the church building. Christian leadership begins in the home. And what it begins with is a respect for God's word and an application of that word. Marry someone who's a good provider, someone who is willing to hold a job and support his family, even if it means doing something he doesn't like while he works towards something that he does. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8 says it very plainly. If anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of the household, he has denied the faith, is worse than an unbeliever. Paul is saying something that you ought to take very seriously. If you marry a person who doesn't have a job because he's lazy and irresponsible and just hasn't found the right fit for him yet, even though there's a bunch of jobs out there, you ought to really consider what is going through that person's mind, and is he going to provide for you in the future? Chances are he's not. You want to marry someone who is also a good protector, not just physically protecting you, but also morally, emotionally, spiritually offering protection as well. In essence, someone who is willing to lay down his life, literally and figuratively, in order to save yours. Someone who values you, young woman, as a fellow heir in the kingdom, like Peter talks in 1 Peter 3, verse 7. Someone who values you like that. And meanwhile, young men ought to be searching for a young woman who is a person of high moral character. She has good self-esteem, meaning she has a positive self-image, because a lot of women struggle with that. She dresses with modesty. She speaks with virtue and grace, rather than the gutter language of the world. She seeks the best interests of those who are all around her. Marry someone who will be a good mother, someone who loves children and looks forward to raising a family in the Lord. Marry someone who is feminine and carries herself with grace and poise and womanly discretion. As you know, many girls today are looking more and more like men and bland in their dress and behavior and their demeanor, or they're more and more like prostitutes and hussies. I don't get to use the word hussy very often in my lessons, so I decided to do that today. But basically, they want to look sexy but not attractive. They want to be flirty but not feminine. In other words, they're actually trying to enhance their physical features so as to attract boys' attention in that respect. And you just think about this. If you're dating a girl who's dressing like that for other boys, what is she saying there? And there's a lot of problems with that. Not only that, but if that's really her concern, then she's got other issues that should be red flags to you. Avoid someone who does not respect herself. Avoid someone who is unwilling to wear a dress and look pretty, or who feels content to wear a t-shirt and sweats wherever she goes with you, but will dress up for everyone else, if you've ever noticed that. Like when she goes to work, it's all pretty hair and makeup and nice clothes, but when she comes home, you know, or comes to see you, or you come over, then there she is in her t-shirt and sweats. So everyone else gets to see her all done up, and when you see her, she's all done down. I don't know how you explain that or express that, all right? So what we're saying here in essence is choosing a marriage partner is the most important decision of your life outside of your commitment to God. It is the second most important decision of your life. Take time then, put much effort into it. The best scenario is, and I have done this with my kids and I encourage them to do it even still, is to write down your expectations ahead of time and keep your eye out for that person that you just described on your list there. One thing ought to be obvious, and that is that if you don't have high expectations for your mate, then that must mean that you also don't have very many high expectations for yourself. You can't expect your mate to conform to your expectations when you don't, or won't, really, is what it comes down to. Not only should someone have something to offer you, but you should also have something to offer them. So take a good, long, hard look in the mirror, literally and figuratively, and examine your own qualities, your own character, your own disposition. What makes you attractive to someone else? What do you have to offer someone else? It's not all about you're sitting back with your clipboard and critiquing everyone else. You need to look at yourself and say, what kind of person am I? And how do I live my life? Again, no one is a perfect spouse. That's not the point. But at the same time, you should not settle for average or below average just because you didn't want to take the time and make the effort to find someone who's worth your time and your effort. It doesn't mean just choose someone based on looks alone. It's better to find someone of a Christ-like character or with the Christ-like virtues. Above all, pray often and earnestly that God will lead you to the person that He has chosen for you, which may not be the person you expected up front, but may be the best person for you, because God knows the heart of all people. I hope this lesson has been helpful. I hope that you have not only found it valuable for yourself, but also for your children and your grandchildren and whoever else you have influence over. This is a good lesson to share with them for these reasons. If there's anyone that's ready to become a Christian or ready to rededicate their life to the Lord, this would be your time to respond. Come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song, Richard is Selected.